Today's Teisho will be on Case 98 in the Book of Serenity. Dongshan's Always Close. Introduction. Zhui Feng, cutting off his tongue, made a sequel to Shi Shuang. Cao Shan, cutting off his head, didn't turn away from Dongshan. The ancients' sayings were so subtle. Where is the technique to help people? Case. A monk asked Dongshan, among the three Buddha bodies, which one does not fall into any category? Dongshan said, I am always close to this. Commentary. In the original verse, not entering the world, not following conditions. In the emptiness of the pot of ages, there's a family tradition. White duckweeds, gentle breeze, evening on an autumn river, an ancient embankment, a boat remains, a single stretch of haze. I want to thank you all for coming here this morning during this Thanksgiving break. As you know, it was very cold this morning. When I got up, I heard on the radio that it was about 16 degrees outside. And when I was driving here, I saw on a bank display that it was about 20 degrees. When I parked out in the driveway here on campus, I looked up and the trees had lost most of their leaves, and just in the distance you could see the sun coming up. And it was so cold and so almost scary when it's that cold. It's a little bit frightening to have cold like that surrounding you. It's kind of a shock to your system. And I have to confess that when I woke up this morning, there was, I had the thought, ooh, it's really cold out there, and just stay under these covers. Mm-hmm. But when I was standing there looking at the sun coming up, looking at the bare trees against the horizon, which was sort of turning sort of reddish color, it was like being on the line between fear and joy. It was so interesting. It was like being on the line between fear and joy. It's the cold scary, but it makes you feel alive somehow. It's a very interesting place to be. And during Sesshin, sometimes it's like that. As you know, we often keep the Zendo a little bit cool in the winter during Sesshin. When you come out of your room and you go through the dining hall. The dining hall is usually at a decent temperature. It's like 70 degrees. And then you go into the sitting room, into the Zendo, and it's cold. And it's slightly frightening. It's slightly intimidating. And then you sit on the cushion, and at first it might be a little bit uncomfortable. But it really can help your sitting. And all of a sudden you can have this feeling, which is like joy. I sort of learned this the hard way, because when we were when I was training in Seattle, at one point we had sitting at the Roshi's residence, at Genki Roshi's residence, which was called Kuge-an. And we would all get up in the morning and drive to Kuge-an, his residence, which was up on a hill. It was actually a very beautiful place to live. And we would go in and sit. And every morning he would open all the windows when we would sit. So it didn't really, you know, matter what the temperature was, Genki Roshi would open the windows, and I'll tell you, that room was so cold sometimes. And I could just, sometimes we'd get there and I'd sit down and he wouldn't have opened the windows yet. And I would think to myself, you know, he might forget today. You know, maybe he'll forget. You know, this is, or maybe, you know how the mind works, you think, you know, maybe it'll be okay. You know, maybe he won't open the windows today. Even though he's opened them every day for years, you know, maybe he won't do it today. And then he'd open them. And then the cold would rush in, you know, and I would sit there in the cold, in the dark, day after day, you know, week after week. And for a long time, I really disliked it. But after a while, I really began to love it. And it's not something you love, you know, in an automatic way. It's not something you love, you know, the way you might love the taste of sugar the first time you taste it. You know, it's slightly scary, and then there's like joy. It's like thrilling, right? Maybe that's what we mean when we say something is thrilling. It's not exactly comfortable, right? But somehow it pushes us into a deeper life. And so, you know, sitting in a cold zendo is not something anybody would choose to do. You know, the reason we have central heating in where we live is that we like to be warm. We like to be comfortable. But, you know, once you're warm and comfortable, it's very hard to actually, I think, sit well. It's an odd fact. You know, people, sometimes I'll ask them how their sitting is during the evening sits. At the end of the evening sits, I'll say, how is your sitting? And people will say, oh, not so good, you know, I stayed up all night, I'm a little bit tired, you know. And I often feel, darn, what a shame, they don't see it yet. But sometimes when you're struggling with something like that, you're tired, or you feel worn out, or you're sick, you know, it's an interesting thing, but in that condition, you can have a kind of openness that that you can't have if everything's, you know, a-okay, everything's just as it should be. You know, sitting when you're sick is a little bit like sitting in the cold, actually. You know, it's not something anyone would choose to do necessarily, but when you do it, it's an interesting experience. It's slightly frightening, you know, and yet, you know, it's very, there's a kind of openness to it. You know, especially if you're really feeling rotten, you know, you can sit on the cushion and think, why am I doing this, you know? And then at first you might feel very weak, very shaky, and if you stay with it, you know, from my own experience, I would say you can begin to get into this place that's really, this, like, joy arises. This is to me quite important. You know, so much of our lives are based upon a certain kind of, sort of like undercurrent of fear. I have had moments in my own life of real insecurity. When I got out of college, for example, I started looking for jobs, and I was nervous all the time. I would go to these job interviews, and I was nervous going into the interview and often disappointed leaving the interview. And I would go home and I would be nervous, you know, just because I thought, what will become of me? You know, there was like this undercurrent of fear in my life. I had friends of mine who were not English majors. They were like engineers or they were business students. And when they graduated, they immediately got jobs. It seemed to me, anyway, that they immediately got jobs. And their lives seemed so coherent and planned out. I had a friend of mine who was an engineer at the University of Virginia, where I was an undergraduate. And even before he graduated, he sent he had sent out like 50 letters to different firms, and they were flying him out to places to interview. Even I was working as a night janitor at a bowling alley toward the end of my college experience as an undergraduate, because I was trying to make ends meet. And my friend was getting flown out to these companies in California. So we were like already sort of living in different worlds, and he seemed to have his act so much together. And I had like, I began to develop this undercurrent of fear. It was like, you know, what's going to become of me? What's going to become of me? And I would go to these interviews, and I almost felt a little desperate. I remember going to an interview to work in a bank. And the man who interviewed me was not very nice, really. He wasn't a very nice guy, as I recall. And he had somehow agreed to interview me, but then he looked at my resume and he said, well, you know, it looks like you've studied English and anthropology. And he really kind of said, what makes you think you could work in a bank? And I felt like saying to him, well, why are you even interviewing me if you don't think I would work out here? You know, I tried to talk about why I might work in a bank, but you know, I really didn't. I felt like, you know, I want to work in a bank because I want a job. You know, that's why. You know, that you have a job and I want one, right? But that wasn't, of course, the answer I gave, and it probably, I don't think it would have been the answer that would have gotten me the job, right? I don't know what I should have said, you know, but. All of this sort of added up for me to like an undercurrent of tension. And I had this feeling like, what will become of me? You know, what is going to become of me? And I had all of these lessons that I had learned growing up. You know, my father was he loved to give me sort of like lay down the law or give me little sayings. So he would say, you know, if you don't work hard, you're going to be a ditch digger. When I was starting out in high school, I wasn't doing very well. I didn't get very good grades. My father used to come into the room at night to see me, and he'd say, you know, Kurt, if you don't, you're going to be a ditch digger if you don't apply yourself. I had never actually met a ditch digger, but it sounded like a terrible life, you know. And so I actually began to study just because I was afraid I was going to become a ditch digger. You know, later I actually did dig ditches. When I was in college, I had a summer job on a construction site and I dug ditches. You know, I thought, this is not so bad. In fact, I liked it. I actually enjoy it. You're outside, you know, you look at the sky. Physical labor is actually good for you, fresh air, you know, it's very nice. But in the 10th grade, it just seemed like the end of the world, right? It just seemed, oh my God, I'm going to be a ditch digger. I better learn algebra, you know? And in fact, I did. I actually became very good in math, you know, and applied myself. And so, you know, somehow when I got out of college, these lessons were in my head, you know, that you're going to be a ditch digger, you've got to, you know, it's a dog-eat-dog world out there, blah, blah, blah. And so I was in this transitional period, and I just had this sort of like undercurrent of anxiety all the time. Like, what is going to become of me? And one of the jobs I had was managing a hotel restaurant. I became the manager of a restaurant, and it was a hotel restaurant, and manager sounded like such a good title. It's like, well, you know, this is a job worthy of my abilities, right? And But actually, it was a terrible job. I had to get there at 7 in the morning, and I would sometimes get home at midnight, you know, because I had to attend to every detail. And even though the sign on my door said manager, you know, if a cook didn't show up at breakfast, I had to put on the apron and go out there and flip the eggs, you know, with the other cooks. And I had to do all the ordering. And if somebody wasn't happy with his food, I had a suit coat, and I would put on my suit coat and go out and say, I'm sorry you didn't like your shrimp, you know, I'll give you some more shrimp, would that help, you know, and I had to try to be, you know, smooth things over. And that was really a difficult job, you know. And again, I had this terrible feeling like, you know, what's going to be, I can't do this for the rest of my life, you know, what's going to become of me? And, you know, I just think that many people have this feeling, this kind of undercurrent of anxiety about not being in the right place, you know, not being able to achieve what we want I don't know what it is. I think it's a very basic fear, sort of like a fundamental distrust in life. It's like we're not going to be what we should be. We're not going to be where we should be. You know, we're not going to, you know, something we need or want is going to never be given to us, or it's going to be taken away from us. This is like very deep fear. And I think many, many things in life contribute to creating this sort of deep elemental fear. Maybe all humans have it. You know, I've certainly had it at various points in my life, you know. It's like something is going to be taken away, and it's going to be irretrievably terrible, you know, when that happens. My mother used to always talk about her ship coming in. She would say, when my ship comes in, and this was one of those sayings that, you know, my mother had her share of these sayings too, and I can see why my father and mother were attracted to each other. You know? Because my mother would say, you know, when my ship comes in, you know, this is going to, I'll get a new car, or, you know. So there's this idea, someday it's all going to be right. And maybe people are really afraid their ship is never going to come in, you know, never going to come in. I think also, you know, that our culture really preys on this fear. It really speaks to this fear in a kind of a deceptive way. I have a friend of mine who's really a wonderful guy, you know, and his wife also, wonderful person. They're really humane people, generous people. And the other day I was having lunch with this friend of mine, and he said, we were talking about his remodeling job on his kitchen, and he said that he's spending $50,000 remodeling his kitchen. And I was just astounded, you know, I just thought that was astonishing. And the interesting thing is that he's been in agony over this just about every day he's been going through this process, you know. So I've seen him fairly often, and this has been like a theme in our conversation. So, you know, one of the problems was the cabinets weren't installed right. Or another problem was that the stone, they brought the countertops, but they weren't right. They weren't the, you know. So there was this just like one frustration after another. And I have the feeling, because, you know, I live in this culture too, you know, I have the feeling that they started out on this process to remodel their kitchen with the idea that, you know, if they just made some changes, it would be a little more comfortable place. You know, but I think the ball gets rolling, and it's hard to stop it. You know, because you start going to showrooms and you start seeing, you know, the perfect kitchen. And then you start thinking, well, you know, we don't really want countertops that are made of formica. Why not the Corian? And then somebody says, but you know, you could have the granite, which is what my friend has settled on now. It's the granite. granite's only a little bit more than the Corian, and that's a little bit more than the Formica. So, you know, pretty soon you're in this thing for $50,000. And you have to ask yourself, you know, I won't say this to my friend because it's, you know, I hope he has a wonderful time in his kitchen. You know. I won't, you know, and I actually like him enormously, and I wouldn't want to criticize him or something, or be, you know, holier than thou sort of thing. But you have to ask yourself, was this necessary? You know, was it really necessary? And, you know, sometimes if you do ask that question of people, they get upset. You know, they'll actually get upset. You know, because I think that what drives this is a kind of elemental fear. It's like, you know, you're trying to take, and if you say, you know, why are you doing this? You know, it's like you're taking something away from me that is, you're taking my dreams away from me. You're taking my dreams away from me. Yeah. And so, you know, people will actually sometimes respond in a hostile way if you say, well, you know, what, do you really need this kind? You really need cherry cabinets? Do you really need, no. You know, there's a kind of a feeling I think people have that if I can just get the granite and I can just get the cherry cabinets with the old world doors, you know, I'll be there. And by implication, if I don't get these things, I won't be there. You know, I won't be there. And I actually think this is seems like such a trivial matter. I have another friend who also remodeled his kitchen about maybe 5 years ago. And when my friend, who's currently in the remodeling process, was talking to me, the words of my other friend were sort of in my ear, ringing in my ear. Because my other friend said, that he and his wife had been married for like 18 years. And he said, we've always gotten along well. He said, the first really terrible fight they ever had was over the kitchen remodeling. And that actually makes a lot of sense if you think about it. Because people get so invested in these projects because it's like, if I don't do this, my ship is not coming in. You know, it's like, This is my dream. You know, if this dream doesn't come true, you know, we won't have wonderful breakfasts in the morning with our sitting around the counter. You know, the eggs won't taste as good. You know, that sort of thing. We know it's sort of ridiculous, but people are driven by this. In the most compulsive way, it's like if this doesn't happen, everything is lost. You know, if this doesn't happen, everything is lost. And I actually, you know, there's so many forms. This takes so many forms. You know, another friend of mine is a very good scholar. His field is. 20th century literature. And he's written kind of a controversial book. And at one point he was in a deep depression because there's a press called Duke University Press. And in English departments, if you get a book at Duke University Press, you are the coolest cat in the neighborhood. You know, if you publish it in like Cambridge or Harvard, you're doing really well. But if you want to be really cool, if you're really like cutting edge, avant-garde, you know, you're really the daring person, you publish at Duke. And my friend was like very, very deeply depressed for, you know, some weeks because he didn't get his book published at Duke. It's like, and really troubled, you know, it's like really, it really like shook his foundations for a while. And this is so common, isn't it? We think if this doesn't happen, it's all over. It we might not even think it intellectually, but we so often behave as though, you know, we're so often driven by this kind of undercurrent of fear. If this doesn't happen, everything is lost. It's all lost. You know, it's all gone. And we live our lives, I think, very often driven by these kind of unspoken compulsions. I have colleagues I work with who are actually upset a lot of the time because somebody else in the department at the same level makes slightly more money than they do. And you can, again, you can say this is so trivial, but it's tied up with this feeling, my life just won't be right if I don't make as much as Bill, you know. So there's something wrong, I think, with the way we live, sort of constantly trying to fulfill our dreams and constantly afraid that that if we don't bring them to realization, don't make them real, you know, everything is going to be lost. A monk asked Dongshan, among the three Buddha bodies, which one does not fall into any category? Dongshan said, I am always close to this. Now, the Buddha bodies refer to different aspects of reality. In Buddhist philosophy, different aspects of reality are characterized as a term for them. And one aspect of reality is called Dharmakaya. This is like a fundamental awakenness. One aspect of reality is called Sambhogakaya. This is like the function of fundamental awakenness. And then one aspect of reality is called Nirmanakaya. These are like terms that are used in Buddhist philosophy. And so the monk is asking Dongshan a kind of an abstract question. He's saying there's supposed to be these three different aspects of reality. Which one is the one I should hold on to? Which one is the one I should hold on to? Which is the supreme reality? Which is the one where I will be liberated, enlightened, happy, safe, etc.? Which one? Nirmanakaya, Sambhogakaya, which one? And Dongshan says, I am always close to this. As far as I'm concerned, the practice of Mu is the foundation of Buddhism, the foundation of Zen, and the foundation of awakening. It's so important to be happy with nothing. And it's so important to be happy with nothing at all. And the truth is, you know, if you can be happy with nothing at all, you can be happy anywhere at any time. You don't even have to do Zen practice to know this. Right? You know, I can tell you from my own experience, or I can suggest to you from my own experience that you know, some of the best times in my life have been times when none of the things I wanted